Critically Linked, How Books of the Past Shape Our Future, a DiscourseNet podcast with Dana Triff and Jaspal Singh.
Hi, my name is Dana Triff.
And my name is Jaspal Singh.
And together we are the hosts of Critically Linked, How Past Books Shape Our Futures, a podcast in which we re-engage with old and sometimes new philosophers. Together with our guests, we want to explore how relevant their ideas are when discussing contemporary challenges. Today, we are introducing a slightly new format.
We have three wonderful guests, Amandine Kingabo, Lupake Dunia Sabhala, all of them bachelor students from UC Louvain, Saint-Louis, Brussels. Coordinated by Professor Thomas Jacobs. Amandine, Lou, and Dunia will be hosting this edition of the podcast with a conversation about Sibo Kanobana's thesis, Serving the White Order, Making Bilingual Security Workers in Brussels. Their main focus will be on Chapter 2, White Governmentality and the Entanglement of Race, Neoliberalism, and Securitization. Based on this chapter, they'll try to answer a main question throughout the podcast. How does white governmentality create racial exclusion in public spaces under the appearance of neutrality? Over to you, Amandine, Lou, and Dunia.
So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm going to be your host. I'm Dunia, and I'm with my colleagues, Lou and Amanda. Amanda, can you say hello?
Hello, everyone.
Lou, can you say hello, too?
Hi.
Okay, perfect. So, in today's episode, we'll be dividing into Sibo Rigweza Kanobana's thesis, Serving the White Order, Making Bilingual Security Workers in Brussels. And we're going to try to answer a main question, that is, how does white governmentality create racial exclusion in public space under the appearance of neutrality? I know it's a big question, so more simplified. Racialist people are put aside in everyday life because of a social order that perpetuates prejudice and that racialization seems neutral as it's part of that social order. It may seem really dense for now, but we'll tackle every point of this question as to understand each concept and then apprehend what's the stake, what's the issue here. But first of all, before we start to answer our main question, I think it's important to know a bit more about Kanobana. Don't you think so, girls?
Yeah.
Of course. So, first of all, Kanobana is a sociolinguistic assistant professor and a former PhD researcher with both Congolese and Belgian heritage. His research is deeply informed by personal experience. He's moved through wider school and city where he felt distinctly Black, and through Blacker environment where he suddenly felt white. One of the major factors shaping these experiences was language. Knowing Dutch often changed how people treated him. Mm-hmm. It became a symbol, not just of communication, but of legitimacy. He was also aware of the way he has benefited from the system through his light-skinned phenotype, social networks, and wealth. His experiences with racialization have shifted dramatically depending on time, place, and who he was speaking to. All this demonstrated that we live in a vacuum in which we become aware of our culture only after we encounter differences. We're exploring the several yet powerful way race, language, and institutional control shape our world. We'll be tracking major themes like race and racialization, neoliberalism, securitization, and the white order. But first, let's start with the foundational concept that helps explain how these forces operate at deeper. And for that, I'm going to let you with Lou, my colleague, who's going to explain to you the white governmentality. So Lou, can you tell us a bit more about the white governmentality, please?
Yeah, sure, Dunia. So the term white governmentality comes from the fusion of Michel Foucault's idea of governmentality and critical race theory. In simple terms, governmentality refers to how people are managed, not just by laws or police, but by norms, expectation, and institutional behaviors. It's not about who's in power, it's about how power works. And when you add race into this equation, Kanobana shows us that whiteness, often unspoken and invisible, becomes the standard by which everything is measured.
Can you tell us what does this actually looks like in everyday life?
Well, let's start with language. In Brussels, Dutch isn't just a means of communication. It's loaded with meaning. It has become a symbol of legitimacy, of being professional, respectable, and trustworthy. But obviously, not just any Dutch. There's an expected tone, a specific accent, a calmness, a smoothness that says, I belong. And this is what Kanobana calls the white voice. It's not only racialized individuals who are expected to use it, it's everyone who wants to be accepted by the system. And this idea, you know, it ties directly into something that we've learned with Mr. Thomas Jacobs, which is linguistic relativity, or also known as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. This theory suggests that language doesn't just reflect our world, it shapes it. The way we speak can influence how we think, how we behave, and how others perceive us. For example, Inuit people, they have like 50 words to say snow, whereas in French, which is our mother tongue, we only have like three because we have different realities. And so when certain ways of speaking, like the white voice, are seen as more credible or professional, it means language becomes a gatekeeper. It decides who gets access to jobs, to resources, or even to respect.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe we can make this real for a moment. Like, imagine a black man working in a metro station in Brussels. He speaks fluent Dutch, maybe even French. He is highly trained, experienced, and competent. But if he doesn't speak with the right tone, or if his posture, body language, or accent mark him as other, then he's still under suspicion. He might still be seen as a risk. So what does he do? He adapts. He cuts switches. He adjusts his tone, his language, his entire demeanor just to be treated with the same respect automatically given to someone white. That's white governmentality in action. It's not written down anywhere. It's not in a rule book. But it governs behavior. It teaches people, especially racialized people, how to perform whiteness in order to survive. And this isn't just a Belgian issue. You can see it playing out globally. Don't you think so, Amanda?
Yeah, of course. For example, take France. There is a fierce debate happening right now around immigration, secularism, and what it means to be French. One part of that debate is that about language. Politicians argue that immigrants need to speak French properly, but in order to integrate. But what does properly even mean? It often means speaking without an accent, using certain kinds of grammar, and behaving in ways that align with white middle class norms. It's a perfect example of white governmentality, where whiteness is treated as the neutral default and everyone else has to prove they belong. In both Belgium and France, and honestly in many Western societies, language has become a tool of cultural imperialism. Just like colonial powers once imposed their language, laws, religion on colonized people, today's institutions do something similar. They impose cultural norms subtly, but effectively, by deciding what kind of behavior is acceptable and what isn't. Then there is reward for those who fall in line.
And let's be clear, this isn't about fairness, it's about power.
Dunja, you're completely right. The system doesn't just refer to whiteness, it produces it as the standard, and it asks everyone else to conform, but not every person can conform. And when they do, it's not always enough. That's the problem here. Because whiteness in this system isn't just about language. It's about how you carry yourself, how you dress, how you smile or don't smile, how loud you speak. It's about every single little detail that mark you as not quite right. For example, I just have this experience in the metro when a Black African person was speaking a bit loud in the metro, and everyone that was looking at him like in a mean way. But it's just a way how he carry himself that it's not the norm of European norm.
Yeah, I remember when you told that story. It was incredible. Now think about this in the context of work, especially jobs in public space. Can Urbana focuses on security workers, people who are meant to embody safety and control. But many of these workers are racialized, so they cut in a double bind. On one hand, they're supposed to enforce the norm of the white order, but on the other hand, they're excluded from it. They have to perform calmness, politeness, even frightness, while also being alerted and authoritative. And if they step outside of that performance, even slightly, they risk being labeled as unprofessional, aggressive, or even incompetent. This is not just emotional labor, it's identity labor, and it's exhausting, actually. Well, you know, at this point, we can start to see how white governmentality connects with other big ideas we'll be exploring later in this episode, such as racialization, neoliberalism, and secularization. But maybe, Lou, you have something else to talk about the white governmentality?
Yeah, white governmentality creates the condition for racialization. So it's the process of marking people as different based on perceived traits like skin color, accent, or behavior. Mm-hmm. It fuels neoliberalism, which tells people that if they're struggling, it's their own fault. And ignoring the system of exclusion that have been in place for centuries. And that feeds into securitization, where public spaces are tightly controlled to appear safe. Safe, but often end up targeting racialized people as threats. And you know, this is the quiet violence of white governmentality. It doesn't scream, it whispers, it doesn't attack, it organizes. And in doing so, it ensures that whiteness stays at the center as the norm, the standard, the invisible ruler against which everything else is judged.
Yeah, and what's even more powerful is that white governmentality doesn't need everyone to believe it. It just needs people to play by its rules, to perform the right identity, to speak the right way, to avoid drawing attention, to assimilate like quietly. All those little things. But what happens when people stop playing by those rules?
Well, that's a question you can ask yourself throughout this episode, because whether it's through protest, cultural expression, or simply refusing to conform, people are resisting these norms every day. And those acts of resistance, no matter how small, are cracks in the system. So to answer our main question, as we move forward in this episode, we need to dive into how these systems work. First, we'll look at the white order as a broader social structure. Then we'll break down how race and racialization function, how neoliberalism justify exclusion, and finally, how securitization turns public spaces into zones of control and suspicion.
But before we get there, you know, let's pause and sit with this idea. Yeah. White governmentality is not just a theory. It's something that shapes how we speak, how we move, how we're seen, and how we see ourselves. It's everywhere. And unless we name it, we can't challenge it. Now that we know a bit more about white governmentality, I think it's time to go with the white order. And Amanda, you know what's the white order.
Yeah. So having explored the notion of white governmentality, we can now turn to a closely related but distinct concept, the white order. So Can Urbana, in his thesis, used the white order to describe the social structures through which racist logics are reproduced in Western societies. Importantly, the white order is not a deliberate project. Rather, it is a hierarchical system in which the sign of whiteness are seen as neutral, universal, and superior. These signs work just to justify the system's inherent structural inequalities. But those embedded within it, the white order is experienced simply as the way things are naturally supposed to be, which makes it challenging it harder.
Well, for people who are listening to us, to be able to understand the white order, they must fully understand what Kanobana means by whiteness. Mm-hmm. Kanobana approaches the concept of whiteness historically rather than biologically or phenotypically. Whiteness is not only about skin color or physical feature, such as blonde hair. It's socially constructed and historically developed. Whiteness is imagined as middle class, while non-whiteness is associated with the working class. It encompasses a broad diversity of culture, language, and religions. The signs of whiteness are tied to dominant ideas about what constitutes a decent human being: hygiene, rationality, order, neutrality, objectivity, and hard work. These signs are deeply embedded in everyday assumptions. As a result, racialized bodies are perceived as not belonging and often are constituting a threat to social order.
Yes, but also, as we mentioned earlier, whiteness tends to be invisible, especially for those who benefit from it. For those positioned outside of it, however, whiteness is profoundly felt. Kanobana argues that whiteness functions as a metaphor for power, something that is naturally carried by those who are socially recognized as white. They might not recognize that the reason why ordinary everyday interactions are unproblematic for them is actually the white order. Therefore, it is important to think about how this order appears to people who do not benefit from it. The white order operates alongside other forms of social ordering, such as the gender order and the class order, and they all influence social interaction in their own ways. But as we know, these structures also intersect and mutually reinforce one another.
I think now, you know, we can connect this idea to the same we see earlier. You know, remember the black man in the metro who's working? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so now imagine a black, very competent security worker, but this time it's a woman instead of a man. It would take her even more effort to not be seen as other, and her stature might be even more precarious compared to a male worker. She might not be taken seriously at all. Prejudice would most likely intensify based on both gender and phenotypically non-white figure. All through the white order privilege whiteness, it's possible for non-white individuals to gain access to its benefits. It says it's often mediated through wealth, upper class status, and the adoption of cultural practice understood as Western. Yet this raises an important question. What are these Western cultural practices? They often include particular ways of speaking, dressing, and behaving, coded signal of rationality, discipline, and professionalism.
Yeah, but here's the tricky part, though. Individuals who could otherwise pass as white might still become suspect if they express in the wrong language or adopt the wrong style. And in this sense, racialization is relational and contingent rather than absolute. And we'll discuss more about that later.
And for me, in organizations such as Brussels Public Transportation Company, it may officially present themselves at multicultural spaces, celebrating diversity in hiring practices. But if belonging is based on white norms, it is worth questioning who actually feels fully included. Superficial diversity does not necessarily dismantle deeper hierarchies. Just like Kanobana says, the presence of racially marked security officers may appear to be kind of progress, where racially marked people are in a position of power. Hiring racialized security workers might seem like the Brussels Public Transportation Company signals a move toward multiculturalism and inclusivity. But at the same time, these workers are subtly expected to speak and act whiter, behave according to a dominant white cultural expectations, and erase visible signs of their racial and cultural difference in order to be perceived as professional and trustworthy. Don't you think so, girls?
Yeah, but just to be clear, when we talk about whiteness in organizations, we're not talking about individuals. We're talking about the background rules that shapes whose behavior is seen as professional and whose behavior isn't, you know? The security workers barely need Dutch in their day-to-day work life. Language proficiency is a marker that ties them closer together with whiteness. Despite their professional roles, racialized security workers must invest a lot of effort into not appearing threatening. Their unambiguously non-white appearance forced them to perform legitimacy on a daily basis, something their white colleagues are not required to do. And the white order therefore compels racialized individuals to continually negotiate their place within the dominant structure.
And you know what, girls? This is exactly how the white orders works, hand in hand with the white governmentality. Through hiring policy, language rules, and cultural codes that seem neutral but are actually exclusive. The system doesn't need to name race explicitly. It manages racialized body through the performance of whiteness. It doesn't allow people to freely express themselves, but instead tries to fit them into a narrow mold that only allows the neutral sign of whiteness. The security guards need to conform to this neutrality, or else they could risk not being hired for this job.
Yeah, and what we know about the white privilege is actually a matter of human rights that should be accessible to all. The issue isn't that some people are too privileged, it's that the system is designed to deny others what should be universal. What I found interesting here is that Canobana mentions that as much as the racially marked are enslaved by their supposed inferiority, white people actually are enslaved by their alleged superiority. As a result, the humanity and mental health of all involved, white and non-white, is negatively impacted. Oh, for example, I have a personal anecdote because I'm actually Rwandese, my origins. I have a different cultures at home. So my culture is like we're very outspoken, very free to say everything we want, speak loudly, and, you know, just to smile and laugh with everyone. But, you know, when I go out of my house and just go in the white world, because in my home it's like a black African house, you know, with every values, every everything. And then when I just go out of my house, you know, with the European world, it's just a different culture and I have to adjust. So it's just, you know, it refers to what Lou and Dunya, you said, it's kind of hard to just switch from one culture to another.
Don't you find it exhausting? Like, I live exactly the same as you, you know? I'm a Moroccan Belgian girl, so it means that everywhere that I go, I have to always switch on my culture because, for example, you know, when I'm here, people see me as a Moroccan girl, so they, you have to, you know, be like them. But when I go to Morocco, people see me like a Belgian girl. And it's exhausting for us because there is nowhere that we can find ourselves like normal, you know.
We
always have to switch our culture and it's really exhausting.
So tiring. It's all right.
Sorry guys. So now that we talk about you know, white governmentality, white order, it's time to talk about race and racialization. Well, actually, When demystifying the concept of white governmentality and the white order, we often talk about racialized individuals or people. But what does it mean exactly, concretely, to be racialized? What does it look like in reality? That's what we're trying to understand in this section. In order to do that, we'll go through three major concepts that you hear more and more for sure these days. That is race, racism, and of course, racialization. And let's begin with the word race that you might have heard in your life, but I'm sure you don't. There's a lot of things that you don't know about it, but don't be sad because Lou is here to give us a lot of information about this word. So Lou, what does that mean, race, actually?
Well, the concept of race is primarily a social construct. It's not a biological fact. It has been used historically to categorize people based on ancestry or perceived physical traits like biology, while biology doesn't provide any consistent or formal basis for these divisions. Instead, race is best understood through social, cultural, and political lens, especially as a tool for power and control. And as said for white governmentality and whiteness, it's a matter of power.
Completely.
Can you say where this word can be like used, you know, the word race?
Well, race used as a biological concept rather than a social construct, so as if it's kind of inside us, has emerged relatively recently during and after the Enlightenment in the 18th and 19th centuries. And the concept was then used as part of an attempt to justify social hierarchies and colonial exploitation through scientific means. And that said, racial thinking predates that period and can be actually traced back to 15th century Iberia during the Reconquista, where religious ancestry like Muslim, Jews, and Christians formed early racial classification. And even then, the policy of blood purity, which, I don't know, Amanda, do you know what's it called in Spanish?
Oh, yeah. Limpieza de sangre.
Limpieza de sangre was established in order to exclude some groups of people, like converted Muslims and Jews, based on their not pure enough ancestry. And that set the stage for racialization as a mechanism for exclusion. Mm-hmm. And this logic extended to the colonies, where colonial elite used blood purity and ancestry combined with class to justify excluding non-European for power. Race and class were thus understood as deeply intertwined. You know, we could say that they're two sides of the same coin, and that they're often linked to economic capital. Racial exclusion was about appearance, but also often about ancestry and social position. But race has also always been fluid and politically contingent. Moreover, race is often disconnected from phenotype and instead driven by political, economic, and social interest. So, as said for the white order, it's not even primarily a matter of skin color or physical feature, but race is used to justify power. And what is essential is that race is a necessary analytical lens allowing the understanding of social processes shaped by power. And Canavana highlights in his work that race is not about biology. It's about who gets to belong, who gets excluded, and who gets to rule. And once again, it is about power. The author focuses on what race does rather than what it is.
You know, it seems like it's always about power. And now that the concept of race is well understood thanks to Lou, I think it's time to move on the other concept of racism. Well, actually, I'm pretty sure that you're like, yeah, I know what does that mean. I know this word. I heard it on TV everywhere. So you might be like, oh, I know what is racism. But trust me again, there is a lot of things that you don't know about it. And don't worry, we have Amanda who's here to give us a lot of information about racism. So Amanda, let's start.
There I am, of course. So the construct of race enabled the emergence of racism. Racism, actually, it's not just a word nor an attitude. Instead, it is a structure, a system, and even an epistemology that is a way of knowing the world, of making the rules, drawing the lines, deciding who counts and who does not. And racism is not just about individuals' acts of hate, because even though those are real and harmful for everyone, they are just the symptoms and not the disease. Just like Charles Myers argues, racism is a political system, and that is why it is the mechanism of structural racism that needs to be tackled. Dutch scholars point out that racism is not just about prejudice, but rather it's a way of seeing what counts as knowledge and what is considered to be the norm. Myers calls it the epistemology of ignorance. Racism revolves around a reality that was built over centuries, guys, through colonization, capitalism, imperialism, that govern how we think now and speak and act today. So did you know that the word racism was coined by someone that will be considered racist today? Someone who believed that assimilation was the best way to deal with Native Americans. In fact, he wanted to erase Native Americans' culture, but keep their bodies, kill the Indians, save the man, he said. We call it epistemicide nowadays. But what counts as race has completely shifted over time. Today, racism often hides behind culture. It is not skin color that people point to. It is values, traditions, and religion. It is what we call cultural racism or colorblind racism. It claims to be neutral, but it still reinforces the same hierarchies.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I just remember? In Europe, when Islam is portrayed as incompatible with European values, that is not natural, but rather it's a phenomenon that is part of a long history of framing certain culture as backward, inferior, or threatening.
Yeah, this logic has been used against anyone seen as outside the so-called civilization norm. Racism coexists with other systems like capitalism, sexism, language, and more, which overlap. So moreover, racism is embedded in policy hiring, as with the security workers in Brussels, like just like Lou said, always part of the wider white order and in the production of knowledge itself.
Well, in that sense, it means that Belgian media and politics discuss ethnic minorities in a way that often mirror the same colonial logic that once justified imperial rule. The migrant problem is not actually a fact, but it's a narrative shaped by a lens that has been used for centuries. And such differences are only problematic when they come across culture and migration. I don't know if you remember, we talk about this in class. You remember?
I was just about to say that, actually. You know, when Mr. Thomas Jacobs said that when in media you hear about wave, flood, or streams of migrants, well, it's actually just a tactic to create urgency and to frame immigration as a problem, you know. And, you know, another thing that they do is othering, which is constructing identity by defining who doesn't belong. And a lot of time this is used in media about migration.
Yeah, I remember this day. You know, actually, I hated this day because it's something that I've seen every day, you know, like, we're here and they talk every day on TV, migration is something bad, we have to find a solution, these mm-hmm. people are not good, these people dress like that, they talk like that. And I'm just like, guys, we're on 2025 and don't you really think that the problem is all these people is like that, is like there is a lot of war, there's a lot of things. And I was like this day, no, we cannot be talking about a hijab or this woman wants to swim with that, and the other people were like, no, she cannot do that. And I was like, you really guys thinking about that? So don't remember me that day, because it makes me so angry, you know? I was like, no, this is not human. You cannot think about that.
Yeah, just like it's the priority. There is so much more problems in the world. Like wearing this or that is not the most important thing to, you know, just move on. Because like, I think girls, we are going too far. We need to go back to the main subject.
So you were talking about racism, no?
Yeah. So racism represents an ideology and a system of knowledge. More than just a hateful behavior, it's a structure that organizes how society works.
Mm-hmm. I think now we can finally try to understand the concept of racialization, because a major focus needed to understand the mechanism that hide behind the white order and thus white governmentality. So let's understand what racialization is and what it does.
Yeah.
So Chan and Lo define racialization as, quote, a semiotic process that naturalizes social differences, end quote. What that means is that it takes things like skin color, language, or religion and treats them as innate, dangerous, or even inferior. And racialization says, who does not belong? And that difference becomes a reason for exclusion. But racialization does not always look the same everywhere, as it can be about skin color, but also about culture, religion, accent, the way you dress, or even the way you speak, like we said. And it always fits into local ideologies and histories. And this is what Boni Urcioli views as, quote, the mapping of non-belonging, end quote. And that map is never neutral, but rather it is a tool that points out who is framed as a threat.
Yeah, you're completely right, Lou, because historically, humans have always drawn boundaries between us and them. And it's simply called the process of othering. Today, such differences are deeply shaped by colonialism and the global expansion of European power. Colonialism did not just conquer land, but also measured, categorized, and redefined people, turning difference into hierarchy. Still, racialization is a universal social process that is not just about being non-white, but about being non-normal, non-belonging, non-us, and thus representing a threat to the social order, to the white order. Actually, guys, wait, because I have a perfect example. Just like I said, I'm Rwandan. And in the history, when Belgian colonizer came to Rwanda, they just divided Rwandan people, like Rwandan tribus. So at first, we were all living like happily. And then they came and divided us. And this division resulted to the genocide, because all those distinctions between people and making feel them like inferior or making feel them like superior can make people feel really bad and thinking about really bad stuff. This led to the genocide in 94 in Rwanda.
Yeah, remember when we saw that. So at this point, we could argue that the racialization operated to the white order is a process resembling the one we talked about it at the beginning of this podcast. That is cultural imperialism. One culture, here the white order, imposes itself upon other cultures considered lower to the one of the white order, but not in a direct way, rather than underlying mechanism. In particular, the white order could be associated with characteristic of Orientalism, that is the representation of other cultures in a distorted, stereotypical, reductive, often considered manner, leading the culture of white order to conduct racism and racialization toward other culture. Racialized groups are seen as threats, as a problem to manage, as people who challenge the imagined order of society, and that's what lays the foundation for the white order. As a result, their behavior is policed more, their difference pathologized, their existence made to feel like an intrusion. But how are people marked as different in this way? Simply by using traits, what Gall and Irving called signs of difference, which can be physical, moral, cultural, or linguistic, and which are assumed to be fixed, inherited, and more importantly, those traits are considered lesser.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like we talked about this earlier, racialization, for instance, in a city like Brussels is a multidimensional system that mixes class, language, culture, phenotype, religion, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. And language, through terms like Muslim or ethnic minority, is used as a tool for power in the sense that they are signals of non-belonging. And it is used by the system and then reproduced in public imagination, and thus the process is perpetuated.
Completely, Lou, because at the end, racialization is how societies make difference, feel dangerous, and how power turns culture into threats, and normalizing thinking that some people are valued more than others. Completely wrong, right? Or mm-hmm. that some people are the problem, even if they did completely nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. So I think at this time in the podcast, for people who are listening to us, it's time for you like to think a bit about what this whole concept of racialization evoke in you. And then an example that follows this whole section on racialization could be the increased tendency to Islamophobia nowadays, related to what was said earlier about the situation in France. You remember, Amanda, I think you talked about that. Muslims are increasingly treated as racialized group and are too seen as threats to the social order. That is the white order. And now it's finally time to see how racialization is triggered in neoliberalism. And for that, again, don't be afraid. Lou's gonna tell us a bit more about neoliberalism.
Let's go, Lou.
Well, you know, in the 70s, there was a significant shift in how race was addressed in relation to the state and the economy. And as the economic structure of the United States began to move towards a neoliberal model, the state started withdrawing from social sports programs, particularly those targeted at Black communities. Mm-hmm. And this period saw the decline of the welfare state and the rise of market policies, of free market policies, which disproportionately impacted Black and Brown communities.
Yeah.
And the state's withdrawal led to a greater reliance on market force, where the economy became the primary mean of shaping citizenship and public access.
Yeah, just like you said, Lou, one of the clearest examples of neoliberalism's impact on racialized public spaces is the shift from social security to state security. Social security programs, which had once offered support to the poor and the marginalized communities, were replaced by policies focused on law and order and security. This new focus on state security meant an increasing reliance on policing and surveillance to maintain social control, particularly in urban areas with high population of Black and Brown people. This transformation helped to solidify the criminalization of communities of color as a necessary measure to control social unrest and economically marginalized area.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the rise of neoliberalism, public spaces also became increasingly privatized, meaning that they were no longer available to everyone. Racialized population were especially impacted as the state adopted a model where economic access dictated who could utilize those public spaces. The securitization of space through surveillance, private security forces, and racial profiling further marginalized non-white groups who were seen as potential threats to the stability and profitability of these privatized spaces. And as a result, people of color were increasingly excluded from the space they once occupied. And this exclusion became both a racial and an economic barrier.
Well, then neoliberalism has also a role in racialized public space. Neoliberalism as an economic and social framework plays a significant role in shaping racialized public space. At its core, neoliberalism emphasized the power of the market over the state and the importance of privatization and deregulation. In a neoliberal society, public spaces are often commodified, turning them into areas with only those who can participate in the market economy are allowed to thrive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And neoliberal policies promote the privatization of formerly public spaces, such as parks, public square, and even housing. And these spaces are governed by market interest rather than community welfare. And as a result, public spaces become exclusive environment regulated not by the need of the public, but by economic interests that prioritize profit and consumer behavior over social inclusion.
Yeah, but wait, girls, because public spaces under neoliberalism are also securitized, which means that they often policed to protect private interests. Security measures such as CCTVs, private security guards, and even racial profiling are increasingly deployed to maintain order.
Mm-hmm.
These spaces are no longer about public welfare or social cohesion, but about ensuring that only economically productive individuals are allowed to navigate them. So for racial minorities, neoliberalism often translates into exclusion. Racialization becomes a tool for social control where communities of color are marginalized and excluded from these spaces in both subtle and overt ways. The economic policies of neoliberalism disadvantage those who are racialized, further pushing them into the margins of public life.
Thank you, Amanda, for clearing us a bit more. And now that we explored how white governmentality and racialization create the social condition that define who belongs and who doesn't, we are going to turn to a space where this is not just symbolic, but very clear. Let's talk about securitization in public space. So at first, it might seem like security in public space is just about safety, preventing violence, fighting crimes. Yet scholars like Foucault teach us that it's actually much deeper than that. What he calls apparatuses of security aren't simply about discipline. They're about managing people as population. For example, if we think of the metro, we picture a flow zone where people move freely. In reality, everything is calculated. Power isn't exercised over territory, but over circulation. Who moves, how fast, in what direction, and so on. This is what Foucault calls biopolitical governance, the management of mobility, behavior, and space of population. The key idea here is that it has to feel normal, not like repression. However, hidden behind this soft routine are powerful systems that quietly control our behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, these systems also create effective atmosphere. That means a place can feel safe or unsafe depending on who you are and how much you are racialized.
Yeah.
And it's not always about visible danger. Sometimes it's just about how space feels. And well, there's another thing. Nowadays, security passes through data. And according to Zubov, surveillance is now synonymous with data extraction. It's not only about keeping you safe, it's tracking everything you do. So, like, how do people move in this place, Amanda?
Yeah, there is just an example where Deleuze writes about a society of control, where infrastructures gives us an illusion of freedom, even if they track us. In addition, Bauman adds that we are accepting this because it gives us certainty. It makes us feel like there is order, even if that order comes at the expense of our freedom. We give up on our rights like privacy and autonomy, and in return, we get to feel safe. But here's where things get the more interesting. Who is actually enforcing this system?
Well, Amanda can maybe answer. You know, usually it's security worker. However, they face a challenging dilemma. They need to smile to be polite and communicate in different language. Even sometimes it's not the case, you know. Their appearance must convey calm and professionalism while they monitor people often similar to themselves. Many of these workers are from racial minorities and must have two-way identity, the watch and the watcher. Ilias describes his as being like chameleon, constantly adapting to match expectation. Althusser would call this situation interpolation, where people are pulled into rules defined by ideology.
Yeah, and workers are drawn into roles that grant authority. They must demonstrate legitimacy in their speech, posture, and look. But nevertheless, they're not police officers. These workers wield state power through institutions like public services, and their job demands emotional labor and require them to stay calm, ease tension, and maintain friendliness without dropping the guard. And this leads to double consciousness, a term from Dubois, which describes knowing how society views you and managing that perception while fulfilling your duties.
Yeah, and to keep going, security also involves statistical analysis. Today's system relies on data rather than force, predicting behavior patterns. If statistics suggest young minority men are more likely to cause trouble, society begins treating them as threats. Authors have different opinions about this topic. On one hand, Derrida calls this symbolic violence because it reduces individuals to categories. Meanwhile, on the other hand, Spivak identifies it as epistemic violence because it erases people's complex identities. This approach is deeply racialized.
Well, yes, Amanda. In Europe, labels like Muslim often categorize people to justify surveillance even when race isn't directly mentioned. Hiss argues that whiteness isn't just an identity, but a framework that organizes space. A safe metro station is perceived as clean, quiet, and controlled when it's aligned with white norms.
And, you know, language plays a significant role, too. In Brussels, although Dutch is rarely spoken in metro interactions, bilingualism is required for security roles, as it symbolizes legitimacy and social standing. And while minorities may be hired, but the top position remain predominantly white.
Completely right. And plus, in addition, metro environments have evolved through the years. Once vibrant and multicultural, they now look like airports, clean, orderly, with a lot of shops.
Yeah, securitization here is tied directly to neoliberalism. Public spaces are being turned into consumer spaces.
Yeah.
If you're not buying or moving, you're out of place. And even shopping is now part of the safety strategy. Buying something signals that you belong. And that's why security workers often remove individuals, particularly if they are minorities or homeless. Architectural change also occurs. You know, benches are removed, harsh lightning are added, and reflective surfaces installed to deter lingering, sending a clear message to consume or move on.
Yeah, and viewing cultures as statistic fosters stereotypes, like labeling young suburban men as dangerous, can emphasize cultural interaction by being more effective. Recognizing that security workers perform cultural roles through their manner of speech and conduct, the most insightful approach examines how spaces are influenced by language, media, signage, and uniforms. Metro stations aren't just physical space, but narratives with underlying assumptions about safety and threats. But Lou, can security ever be genuinely neutral?
Well, we can easily see that securitization is everywhere. For example, the COVID-19 pandemic brought about more security measures, such as health checks, QR codes, and increased police presence. And this reflects Foucault's ideas about how authorities manage disease like smallpox in history.
Yeah.
So, moreover, in 2023, France banned the abaya, citing reasons like neutrality and security. However, this ban mainly targets Muslim girls, similar to how metro security often focuses on certain people. Nowadays, with AI and predictive policing, algorithms decide who might be a risk, taking over what statistics used to do. It's a new form of interpolation, a concept developed by Althusser. He explained how individuals become subjects by being recognized or healed by ideology. Like when a police officer say, "Hey, you," and you turn around, accepting your position as the one being addressed. Today, this process happens not just through people, but through systems, cameras, data, and software. This technology categorizes individuals based on race, class, or location, often without any human interaction. Being stopped in a metro station or being constantly surveyed in a neighborhood like Molenbeek is not random. It shows how certain bodies are marked and framed as risk just by existing in space. This portrayal isn't accidental. It's a part of how security is conceptualized. Additionally, there's anti-homeless architectures, benches with bars and spikes, or area without shelter aren't just design choice. They send a message: this space isn't for you. Public area seems welcoming only to those who shops conform and fit in.
So securitization isn't only about safety. It's also about power, control, and deciding who feels secure and who doesn't.
Again, everything is about power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always, all the time. Girls, as we conclude, let's reflect on what we've discussed to answer our main question, which is, how does white governmentality create racial exclusion in public spaces under the appearance of neutrality? We have explored concepts like white governmentality, racialization, neoliberalism, and securitization. These are more than abstract ideas. They shape our everyday experience, from how we communicate with the spaces we occupy, deciding who we trust or fear. Don't you think so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
these systems
totally
influence what feels normal and safe and what feels out of place. Kanobana's work highlights these dynamics, especially in public spaces like the metro, where freedom of movement exists, but with condition. Safety is offered, but not everyone experiences it the same way. It protects some while policing others.
And this brings us to the question, what kind of society do we want to create? Do we want one where safety relies on exclusion and surveillance, or one where safety comes from inclusion and fairness? It's not just about who gets included, but under what condition, whether it's about language, employment, or urban spaces.
So people, next time you're in a metro station, encounter a security guard, or sit in a public square, think about this. Who feels safe here? Who is acknowledged, and who is quietly excluded? Recognizing these dynamics is the first step toward changing them. And yes, everybody, this is unfortunately the end of our podcast. We would like to thank Jafar and Dana for having invited us today. And thank you for listening. See you in the next episode.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.